This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
It's pretty hard to nail down the causes of our current economic crisis. Is it double dealing between Washington and Wall Street? Is it the shocking realization of peak oil, or is it both? Our guest, Dave Cohen, can help. He's published widely in energy circles. Dave is an analyst and contributor to the Association for the Study of Peak Oil and Gas, known as ASPO. Dave, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Pleasure to be with you.
Recently, your article at energybulletin.net warned the oil situation is really bad. Who says so?
Well, actually, it was whistleblowers at the International Energy Agency in Paris that said so. Of course, we peak oil people have been saying that for years, but what happened to us in this case was The Guardian, the UK newspaper, published a story in which they said that the IEA had been distorting the facts, that they actually knew that the peak oil situation is sort of dire, but did not want to publish that because they were under pressure from the Americans not to, and secondly, they felt like they didn't want to cause panic in the markets. So that was the premise of the article.
Well, we found out last year when the prices went up for oil to almost $150 a barrel, what havoc that can wreak on our economic situation. So you could see why people would be worried if an authority like the agency comes out and says that we're running short.
Oh, yes, you sure can. The price shock that we had seems to have disappeared from memory, and it was just last year, which is kind of alarming. The notion that we'll go forward without a similar shock sometime in the next 3 or 4 or 5 years is naive at best. It's clear enough that if the global economy recovers to any extent at all near pre-2008 levels, we'll see oil shoot up again into the same price range, and the effects will be the same. The effects of an oil price shock are always recessionary.
Last June, you wrote a piece, The Decline of the American Empire, which has since spread all over the net. What led you to such a pessimistic view?
I don't know. Maybe I'm just what the people in the markets call a perma-bear, but it means I'm sort of a permanent pessimist. But what I had noticed, this is especially since President Obama came in, and I voted for him. Lots of people voted for him. And, you know, it was change you can believe in and so forth and so on. Even before he became president, he hired the same people who were largely responsible for getting us into the financial mess. He hired them to run it. And then subsequently, we got into various legislative initiatives were made for various issues like climate change and health care, various other things, financial reform. And a pattern emerged, and it's a very clear pattern, in which the legislation is introduced, goes nowhere, it gets shelved, and then they go on to the next issue. And I realized that there was that pattern. What I was trying to do in the decline articles was describe that pattern, so I came up with what I called the vicious cycle of futility. The vicious cycle is essentially you have a problem, and the problem gets worse. And think about health care costs or the finance system. And it runs into what I call social inertia. And social inertia is often expressed, in my example, it's often expressed by political inertia, essentially corruption. And what happens is that corruption becomes more entrenched. And so what happens then, of course, is that the problem gets worse, and that's the circle.
Well, boy, that's a little bit discouraging, but that does seem to be what's happening. We even see it with the climate change thing in Denmark. Now they're saying, well, we'll get all the world leaders together, but we won't really do anything. So we're into an age of futility. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. I'm sorry to be so down about it.
Okay, well, moving forward, I was captured by some of the shocking data and ideas in your follow-up article, November 5th. You itemized some of the signs of financial decay, if not a coming collapse. Let's take the example of the giant American finance company, CIT. Can you tell us about that?
Well, CIT is a major major funder of middle and small-sized businesses and retail businesses, probably ones that you shop in all the time. And they got themselves into trouble. And I don't have a lot of background on that, but what happened was is that they were obviously bankrupt. Being bankrupt, then the appropriate measure would have been to put them into formal bankruptcy and to get them going on a new basis, much like what was done with General Motors. But instead, in this particular case, the Treasury gave CIT $2.3 billion and pretended, essentially, that CIT was solvent. And as a result of the unavoidable bankruptcy, which occurred just last month, the taxpayers lost all of the money that the Treasury put into the dying company. And so that was an example of what's called extend and pretend, where you basically dump money into an institution, a banking institution, which is insolvent, and you pretend that they're not insolvent. And when, of course, the unavoidable occurs, they do become bankrupt, we lose the money, essentially. And that was a case of futility in the financial world.
And it's going on in Britain, where they've just dumped unimaginable amounts of money into big British banks, and they still need a second bailout. And I think, couldn't we say the same thing about the too big to fail American banks?
Oh, sure. There are various cases. In some cases, like Citigroup, they've been effectively nationalized. So the U.S. government is not going to allow Citigroup to fail under any circumstances I can think of. Other ones like Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac have been nationalized. But there are still other banks like J.P. Morgan Chase, Bank of America, that if you were to look at the assets on their books and mark them to market, so to speak, and actually, you know, take what their real value is, then losses would have to be recognized, and in those cases, those institutions would probably be recognized as insolvent. However, this is an extend and pretend situation, like I said before, where they pretend that these institutions are not insolvent and hope for the best. That's essentially the strategy.
That's our plan.
That's the plan.
Well, meanwhile, the stock market's way up for now. Even as 500,000 more Americans lose their jobs every month, production is way down, but stocks are way up. What risk does that pose for America's biggest banks?
Well, I don't think the stock market per se poses a lot of risk for the banks. Depending on how much money they're putting into stocks, there's a thing called the dollar carry trade going on. And what the dollar carry trade is that anybody can borrow money, dollars specifically, at almost zero interest rates and invest those dollars in other assets that have higher rates of return. So that's why the stock market, that's why the S&P 500 is in a bubble, because essentially everybody is borrowing dollars and throwing it at all sorts of asset classes, including commodities like oil or equities like stocks. So I'm not sure if it pertains to the banks per se, but that's why there's a bubble in the stock market.
Good enough. Well, this is Radio EcoShock. We're talking with energy researcher and writer David Cohen. You found a report from the German Deutsche Bank suggesting that half or almost half of all homeowners with a mortgage will owe more than their homes are worth. And then there's commercial building loans. How serious do you think the real estate situation is in the United States?
It's very serious indeed. What has to be understood at this point is that it's really too early to say exactly what's going to happen, because the commercial real estate. Okay, let's talk about, there's two kinds of real estate, and I think you mentioned them, residential and commercial. In the residential market, essentially, what's going on now is the Federal Reserve is buying what are called mortgage-backed securities at an enormous rate. They have a program which I believe is going to end at the end of the first quarter in 2010 to buy $1.25 trillion worth of MBS, mortgage-backed securities. So essentially, they are supporting that market artificially. Now, what the concern is that what happens when they withdraw that support? Will we have a residential real estate market that can stand on its own? Now, people like myself, who, and many other economists, I'm not an economist, by the way, feel that it really can't. So essentially, you have a bind. You either maintain that support indefinitely, or you take it away, and then the thing crashes again. In commercial real estate, U.S. banks hold about $1.7 trillion worth of commercial real estate loans. And in this case, the commercial real estate, like in housing, is declining in value and very rapidly at this point. So those losses, as we were talking about extend and pretend earlier, those losses are not being recognized on the balance sheets of the banks, but they continue to accrue. Now, how do you get out of that situation? God only knows. I guess you should ask Ben Bernanke.
Oh, I'd hate to ask him because, as you mentioned, the new government proposals to fix the financial situation, they might as well have been written by Bernie Madoff, in my opinion. For example, can you tell us a little bit about that Stability Improvement Act or maybe something on the regulations on derivatives? Or?
Well, that's very complicated stuff, and I'm going to sort of back off a bit. I'm going to ask your listeners to read my Decline of the Empire, Now What? Article, which was the second one. The first one was called The Decline of the American Empire. What I was doing was I was listing examples of futility in finance, essentially. And the Improvement Act was written by both the Treasury officials and Barney Frank. And I don't know about the Treasury officials, but I don't think Barney is necessarily corrupt. I just think he's co-opted. The legislation essentially lists institutions. It mandates that there will be a list of institutions that are too big to fail, and that list will never be revealed to the public. Now, at this point, of course, you know, they have hidden all the goodies from the public, and essentially they're free to regulate these institutions in any way, or not regulate them as the case may be, in any way they like. And there is essentially no accountability in the act. So that's the improvement.
It seems almost like a kind of Soviet shadow financial system to me. It's a little bit scary, I got to tell you.
Yeah, it's really scary. I think it's really hard to come to grips with the idea that you don't live in a democracy. I think we all think that we've always thought that we live in a democracy, that we have a voice, that we have some power, that if we cast our votes in the right way, that the new people we put in there will take care of us. And I'm afraid that's all sort of gone now. But it's not. It's much more subtle than what the Soviets ever did. But it's still as effective. We don't really have any opportunity to make some noise about what goes on.
Well, here's my beef. It was obvious in the '60s that oil wasn't going to last forever. I think they even taught us that in school. And in the '70s, a child could see the Earth's resources in general are limited. Even gold, we find out we're reaching peak gold, according to the biggest producer. Yet somehow we forgot all that. We lived like there's no tomorrow. Now the bill is coming due. Nobody can pay it.
Right.
What happens now?
That's the perennial question. I can't tell the future, but the indicators are bad. And when you say can't pay the bill, see, that's very interesting because there's an additional aspect to this. On the current irresponsible fiscal spending policies that the government has invoked, that road they're going down, there's a serious question of default by the United States government. And there's a serious question of bankruptcy. So when you talk about pay the bills, I'm not sure how that works out, really.
Yeah, they're trying to say, well, future taxpayers will pay these ever-inflating costs, and yet if the economy isn't going well, you won't have the tax bills coming in to pay it, and so maybe our foreign creditors will lose. We don't know.
Well, that's the thing. We won't have the revenues, right? Because I assume that the economy is going to be in a recession-like condition for years to come, and the revenues will be down. The only alternative, you know, is to tax people. Well, there are actually two things you do: you cut spending and you tax. And in either case, since it's only spending which is basically keeping the economy going, then cutting spending is going to have bad effects. Or if you tax people who are already under pressure, financial pressure, then that has bad effects. So it's hard really for me to see how we get out of that hole. But the one thing about this, all this fiscal stimulus that's happening now, by the Treasury and the Fed. This is all meant to boost short-term GDP numbers, and so with the kind of hope that the economy will sort of, that dead battery in your car will actually, is not dead. It will really start up if you just turn the key harder and over again. And I just don't think that's going to happen. So it's, and then there's another aspect to that, which is the declining dollar. And there's one view of things, which I think is probably right, which is just that the United States has accumulated so much debt that there are two ways to solve debt when it's unpayable. One, you can inflate your way out of it, or two, you can just go into bankruptcy. Now, assuming the government doesn't want to go into bankruptcy, and of course that would be the case, then they have to inflate their way out of the debt. And inflating their way out of the debt, you talk about paying the bills, for instance, the gasoline bill. If you're inflating your way out of the debt, then you are decreasing the purchasing power of dollars, and who are the people who have to use dollars? Americans. So it's a very bad situation.
Can you give us a peek at what you're working on next, what your current interest is?
Well, I actually am working on, are you familiar with the film The End of Suburbia?
Yes, I am. In fact, we did a radio interview with the producers of that.
Oh, okay. Well, The End of Suburbia is usually chalked up to the petroleum situation, and I think that's right. If you look out over the next 10 years, eventually you do get to the point where oil is on a regular basis is so expensive that nobody can afford to live in these outlying areas anymore. But I'm trying to look at The End of Suburbia from a purely economic standpoint, and I believe I can argue that essentially that the suburban expansion that has occurred for decades here in the United States is essentially no longer affordable, even if oil were cheap.
Very, very interesting. Well, as we wrap up, is there anything else you'd like to leave with our listeners?
Well, yeah, I think I ended one of my columns by saying if life hands you lemons, make lemonade. So I don't want anyone to get too bummed out about any of this. I mean, you know, you have your personal life, and you can take some steps to keep it intact and to save yourself. And so just because the big picture looks bad doesn't mean that everybody's lives have to deteriorate.
I agree with you completely. We've been talking with Dave Cohen, one of the lead thinkers on peak oil and our social situation. Read his posts at aspousa.org, energybulletin.net, theoildrum.com, and many other forums. Thank you, Dave, for sharing with us.
Well, thank you.